What we're talking about is late night, early morning low clouds. With a chance of fall, chance of showers in the afternoon, with a variable high cloudiness, gusty winds at times around the corner of Sunset and Alvarado. Yeah, I know things are tough all over. When the thunderstorms start increasing over the southeast and south central portions of my apartment, I get upset. And a line of thunderstorms was developing in the early morning hours ahead of a slow moving cold front. Cold blood. With tornado watches issued shortly before noon Sunday for the areas including the western region of my mental health. And the northern portion of my ability to deal rationally with my disconcerted, precarious emotional situation. Cold out there. Colder than a ticket taker's smile at the Ivor Theater on Saturday night. Flash flood watches cover the southern portion of my disposition. Yeah. There was no severe weather well into the afternoon, except for kind of a lone gust wind in the bedroom.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Friday. And this is going to be a great Friday. I want to start out by giving you the good news. We've got Lieutenant Colonel Karen Katowski on today, and we are going to drop some bombs on everybody. Karen was a Pentagon insider, and she has been talking about what she knows about the lead-up to the war and many other things. But before we get to the interview, right after the first break, I just thought I would talk a little bit about what I've been reading here. I mean, I don't know how many of you have been watching the false president talking to Vladimir Putin, and they're talking like, you know, Vlad this and Vlad that, but you can see these men's faces. This guy Putin does not like George at all, and you can see George the inbred president with his beady eyes looking around going, oh my God, what is going on here? And I mean, just the photograph they've got, you can see an incredible photograph on the SMH.com. Man, it's unbelievable. We are in some hot water with the Russians, and there's been a lot of talk over the months that Russia is actually setting up as a diametric to the United States, and there's possible war in the future here. And there's a lot of people up in the higher levels of policy analysis who think that that's probably true. And some of this other stuff going on in the news, still talking about us trying to get ourselves involved in Iran. And one of the things I want to talk to Karen about today is, you know, we're both parents and have children, and there's a lot of listeners out there who have kids. Not my kids, guys. Georgie's war here. Not my kids. No way. You know, I'll fight to defend my country, but not go over there and trying to steal oil and be an imperialist. That's not going to happen, not with my children. Anyway, so that this interview is going to actually expose a lot of stuff about the way that the Pentagon, what do they call it, sexed up the information? That sounds right to me. And they actually lied. They bold-faced lies. Stuff just made it up as they went along. Doug Fife's office, Rumsfeld, the whole bit. You know, this was a big lie. And if this stuff ever hit the mainstream media, which they won't touch this with a 10-foot pole, but if it ever did, these guys would be on the carpet for this. But again, proud to be an alternative news reporter here, and that's my job. Trying to give you the best and the best interviews I can find, ladies and gentlemen. And we are going to have a great one right after the first break. So stay tuned for Lieutenant Colonel Karen Katowski. from the break here, and we, you know, my goal, as I've told you all before, is to get the best interviews I can find, and I serve you. My name is Daryl Smith. I am the witness, and my job is to get you the best interviews available. And today, I'm proud to say, we've got someone very courageous that's going to speak today. She actually spoke out against what she saw in her job, and that's not an easy thing to do when you're working in the job she had. And I'm going to let her tell you exactly what happened. Karen, now welcome to my show. Karen? Hello, Karen.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Yes. I'm gonna let you do a thumbnail sketch of what, you know, the conditions by which you spoke out and what your role and what your job was, so okay. People can have an idea.
Sure. Well, I spent 20 years in the military, and by the time I had reached my 18th year, I was working at the Office of Secretary of Defense up in the Pentagon, at the higher levels of the Pentagon, particularly in the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy. I had been working Sub-Saharan Africa policy issues, which were of no interest to the Bush administration or, for the most part, the Clinton administration either. And I was happy and a good conservative, former Republican, now Libertarian. Everything's cool. But I was moved into another part of policy, the part of policy that does Middle East affairs, Middle East policy. In particular, I worked North Africa, and I sat in the same area with the folks working Iran, Iraq, and all of the Middle East area. So I got to witness the formation of this Office of Special Plans, which came from the place that I worked. And I got to witness the people that were making a lot of the policy decisions, primarily the civilian leadership, political appointees, primarily neoconservatives in their political leanings. And I got to watch them promote a war that had no justification in the intelligence whatsoever. It was simply something that they had wanted to do. As I found out from coworkers, I was pointed in various directions. It turned out this is something they had long wanted to do, long before they joined the Bush administration. So I had my eyes opened for me by virtue of the fact of a rather accidental posting in this Middle East policy area at the top of the Pentagon. So I was close to my retirement, and I began initially complaining, of course, and doing just what normal people do when they see things around them that don't look to be quite right. I asked questions. I tried to educate myself as to what was going on. At some point in 2002, about the time President Bush and Vice President Cheney began to really frighten the American people with a number of false stories about the threat that Iraq posed to the United States and to American interests. About that time, August of 2002, I began to write anonymous articles which were posted out on the web at David Hackworth. He's a retired Army colonel, very well known, most highly decorated guy alive, I think. Hackworth runs a website called Soldiers for the Truth, and he was interested in my observations from inside. So I began to write him periodic postings about what I was seeing. And I put in my papers for retirement, and I moved my retirement date up and finally got out of there. And as soon as I was retired, I began to speak out publicly. I didn't speak out publicly by name while I was still in the military. I'd probably ended up in Leavenworth if I'd done that. So, but as soon as I retired, I began to write publicly and do some speaking, but primarily just writing articles, op-eds, and sorry about the dogs here.
That's okay.
But I began to speak out a little bit and do the part that I could do, which was very small, but to simply bear witness to the kinds of the way American policy had been made and is, and quite frankly, is still being made by this administration. That's kind of it in a nutshell.
Well, there was never any intention of these people to tell the truth, I'm sure.
In other words.
Did they ask you, Karen, did they ask you at that office to design a false truth, or did they make it up as they went along?
The agenda was to topple Saddam Hussein, and that was apparently something they had had in mind long before 9/11. 9/11 was a convenient opportunity to begin to prepare their case for toppling Saddam Hussein. And it wasn't just toppling Saddam Hussein. We needed to be there. We needed military bases in Iraq in order to vacate some of the property that we had in Saudi Arabia that was not working out for us. The best real estate in the Middle East for both oil and for security of our neighbors and friends, or our allies there, is Iraq. There's no doubt about it. And they had had their eyes on this for some time. When they came in after 9/11, and even before 9/11, I mean, the demonization of Saddam Hussein, the creation of a false story about the threat that he posed, was there. It was being built. The way they did it, though, was, I mean, the way most propaganda is done. You take a little bit of truth, and then you dress it up the way you want to. You put it in a different context. And so there was some truth. In the 80s, in the 1980s, Saddam Hussein sought nuclear fissionable type materials. He was in the late 1980s. He was trying to develop a capability, a nuclear capability. Is that true in the 1990s? No, it wasn't true in the 1990s. It didn't matter. Because in the 1980s, all they have to do is take the date off and say Saddam Hussein seeks these weapons. And so it was a minor shifting of the truth. It's certainly not the whole truth. I mean, if you had, you know, your child came to you and you said, tell me the truth, and he told you just a little piece of it, and then he exaggerated some other stuff and left out the most important part, then you wouldn't consider that to be the truth. You would say, that's not the truth. And that's what these guys did. They didn't make it up as they went along. They had an objective. The objective was to get this country into Iraq in a military occupation and to have those bases built and to have a friendly or puppetized government that would do what we wanted him to do, which is certainly what Saddam was not doing. Saddam was not doing what we wanted him to do. I mean, he's
so far so good. I mean, so far so good.
They've done very well for themselves, and quite frankly, and I think people that are listening around the world to this will understand very clearly that the architects of this war have not lost their jobs in the Bush administration. They have all been retained. We have Rumsfeld is still there, Wolfowitz is still there. The Undersecretary for Policy, Doug Feist, is actually going to be leaving this summer, but he certainly was retained long past his he's actually quite incompetent, and he was retained long past that normally, you know, many calls have been made for his resignation, and he's being allowed to leave this summer. But all of the architects, all of the people that had to do with the thinking behind this and the design of the propaganda that led to this war, in the incredibly, what seems to be incredibly stupid management of the occupation, but in fact is not stupid, none of these folks have lost their jobs. They have done precisely what the Bush administration has asked them to do, and they have, and they're being rewarded for it. So I think you have to look at that. They are doing very well in Iraq. It is going exactly as planned.
Let me ask this question. I mean, you alluded to this, I think, in some of the writings I read from you. There is a definite connection between the Israeli planning part of this and the American planning. And you actually wrote that there were actually people, the Israelis would arrive at the Pentagon and be wouldn't even sign in.
Well, I witnessed that. I didn't work the Israeli desk. And there was a time, one time in around December, I think it was late November, December of 2002, before the invasion of Iraq, before our invasion. And I was asked to substitute for a guy to escort these Israeli generals and folks from the embassy, but primarily it was about a group of four or five Israeli generals in civilian clothes. I was called just as a substitute to go down and escort these people. Now, we escort people all the time in the Pentagon. So we another guy and myself went down to get these guys and bring them up to Doug Feist's office. And, you know, we brought them in. They did have to wait outside the building. But as soon as they were in the building, they took off at a high rate of speed directly to Doug Feist's office, which indicates that they knew where they were going. And in the Pentagon, if any of people have ever been there, you have to know where you're going. If you don't know where you're going, your tendency is not to walk very fast. It's to try to orient yourself and find out where it is that you're trying to go. These guys knew exactly where they were going, had been there many times before. We followed them down the hallway. They got into Doug Feist's office and proceeded to walk through the waiting room and burst into his office. He had a guest. His secretary jumped up and said, look, you got to wait. He's got somebody in there. And so they sat down very impatiently and stood around and waited. Some were sitting, some were standing. And during that time, I was still there. the coworker and I who had escorted them were there, and I noticed that the sign-in book was there, and we had been we were required in all of these guys' offices are special compartmented information facilities, which means they meet special security criteria and have special security requirements, including the signing in of all people that aren't previously cleared. So, and you can have a clearance, but if you're not a Pentagon employee, you still have to sign in. So I looked at the book and I said, well, these guys have, you know, I thought to myself, well, here, we'll give them something to do while they're waiting. And I said, I asked the secretary, do you want these folks to sign in? And she threw up both her hands and waved no and shook her head very adamantly. No, these guys don't have to sign in. And that was very unusual. That was very unusual because...
No record, huh, Karen?
Well, they don't want a record. And there's very much a sense of, it's not just that they don't want a record. They're not afraid of being found out. It's a sense of intimacy, of policy intimacy, of two countries that are very intimate that is beyond what most Americans can even conceive of. I mean, most Americans think of America first. They think of America as their country. But the folks, particularly many of the neoconservatives in the Pentagon, the ones that I personally know and witnessed in action, these folks have a very much sense of a dual loyalty. They do not feel that Israeli interests are very much different at all from American interests. And it's difficult for an outsider, it's difficult for an average American to really understand this, to really get this. But that's the situation.
Well, you know, that's not surprising to me or our listeners here. So what we're going to do after the break, we've got a six-minute period after the break. We're going to develop a couple of other questions. Karen, please stick with me. Ladies and gentlemen, we'll be right back with Lieutenant Colonel Karen Kotowski. Ladies and gentlemen, we're back, and we've got a great interview going here. My name is Daryl Smith. I am the witness, and you can contact me with any questions about my show at iamthewitness@hotmail.com. Karen, you know, I want to ask you this. You know, it's pretty clear that this poser we have as a president is not the sharpest knife in the drawer, and I see that he probably was not really involved in much of the planning for this, but I do have a sense that the vice president was. And I'm wondering if you saw the vice president's footprint on the Pentagon's spin room for some of this stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one of the things that stood out to a lot of us in the Pentagon staff officers who had worked there before under different administrations. Noticed something very, very unusual, and that was the connection that this Undersecretary for Policy Near East South Asia, the Middle East desk, my boss, Bill Lutie is his name. I think he's still there. I think he's still in charge, Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Near East South Asia. In any case, was appointed into that position from Dick Cheney's office. He came from the Vice President's office before he came over to the Pentagon. He arrived there in, I think, the summer of 2001, from the vice president's office. He had worked previously for Cheney when Cheney was the Secretary of Defense. So they had gone way back to 1991. And this guy was a total committed neoconservative in terms of his political perspectives, which is a perspective that holds the Middle East as a very special interest to the United States and not just as a coexisting area, but an area that we need to be heavily militarily involved in. Not only was he appointed from the vice president's office, but they had a very close relationship. And I remember the very first staff meeting that I went to in, I think it was late May of 2002, they kept talking about a guy named Scooter. And a lot of military generals have nicknames, and you may not call him General Smith. You might refer to them as their nickname, Spike or whatever, some usually dog-type names or something.
Yeah.
And so I heard this name, Scooter, and obviously it sounded like a nickname. And I thought it was a general down in the Joint Staff, or maybe perhaps on the OSD staff that he was referring to. And I asked my coworker after the meeting. I said, "Who's this Scooter he keeps talking about? That he needs to get papers over to Scooter, and Scooter asked for this. We need to get it back to him by this afternoon, whatever." And he goes, "Yeah, that's Scooter Libby over in the Vice President's office. It was Dick Cheney's chief of staff." So the relationship was very intimate relationship with the Vice President's office, very much close. Lots of information sharing, lots of direct tasking. And the direct tasking, I think, is what stood out to most of us in the Pentagon, that That is not how it works. If the vice president wants something from the Pentagon, he asks the Secretary of Defense, and it comes down from the Secretary of Defense. But this
so
is
he
direct.
Was the man behind the curtain then?
In many ways, certainly he had his hands all over Middle East policy in 2002 when I was there, and early 2003.
Well, you know, one of the things that I noticed, you know, and most of the American public can remember this, most of the listeners can, is the presentation made by Colin Powell. And, you know, Colin, being an ex-joint chief, must have had a lot of contacts in the Pentagon. Did your office get contacted by Colin Powell regarding this information that he was going to put out?
Well, I think that if you're referring to his Colin Powell's capitulation speech to the UN, where he listed basically came on board in agreement with all of the false propaganda.
Yes.
That particular one, that was a capitulation of Colin Powell. He certainly got that information from the Pentagon. We viewed, many of us staff officers who had a great deal of concern about the neoconservatives, about the agenda that was being pushed, about the falseness and the unreliability of the information that was being used as fact. We saw Colin Powell for a long time as someone who was standing up for the truth. And Colin Powell specifically was responsible in November of 2002 in postponing the inevitable invasion of Iraq by at least several months when he forced the president to go back to the UN one more time. And during that time when Colin Powell did that, he was very much bad-mouthed publicly to us, even lower-level staff officers. He was referred to as a traitor. He was referred to as someone who needs to be fired immediately, that kind of thing. They were very angry that Colin Powell had succeeded in postponing this invasion. But by February, the invasion, of course, had been planned. It was ready to go in by December, I think. But by February and early March, when it actually went, Colin Powell, by that time, had come on board. Of course, if you recall that speech that he gave, every bit of it was a lie.
Yeah.
Not a single thing that he said has been held up as being true. And it's interesting because David Kaye, who was very much a supporter of the neoconservative agenda in Iraq, had gone way back with Iraq, had a great deal of concern, and very much, I think, believed many of the stories that were being put forth by Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz and Cheney, actually, you know, went in with his 2,000 people and free reign over the entire country to find these weapons of mass destruction. Of course, David Kaye says, not only did we not find them, I have come to the conclusion that they were never there. And, of course, that's what intelligence had said as well. The intelligence had said in the late 80s, by the early 90s, by the time of the repulsion, Gulf War I, when we kicked Iraq out of Kuwait, basically by that time nothing else had happened. They simply, a combination of sanctions and constant observation and pressure with the northern and southern no-fly zones, constant, you know, bombings. I mean, we weren't just observing. We were dropping bombs on his military facilities in the north and in the south for 12 years. That all of these things had pretty much prevented Saddam Hussein from doing anything that we didn't know about. And so,
you know, I have a good friend, Imad Kaduri, actually, that I've spoken to. And Imad was in country until 98.
Mm.
And he told me exactly the same thing. He said, we were having trouble getting our drinking water. Excuse me, too. So the truth is that you're right on the money here. We got a lot of other questions for you right after the break, Karen, and we've got a nice 25 minute stretch coming up. Stay with us, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Daryl Smith. I am the witness, and we've been talking to retired Lieutenant Colonel Karen Kotowski. Karen, you know, it's pretty clear what you're showing us right now is the truth, and we kind of knew this from day one, many of us. But here's the interesting thing: the European press was not on board with Bush during this push to Iraq. We were over here getting a very different view of the evidence, in fact. And I live in a country that absolutely refuted most of the information that was being put forward by George Bush. Now, some of your information after you retired, did you approach the press with these revelations about the lies and about the stuff? And could you tell me what kind of response you got from them?
Well, the first thing I did when I was retired in the summer of 2003 was I, and on the advice of a former Navy secretary who actually emailed me out of the blue and said, you need to write an op-ed. He had read some of the things I wrote for Lou Rockwell and some of the things I had written for David Hackworth, and he out of the blue emailed me and said, you need to put your thoughts in a short opinion piece, and he says, I will help you get that published in the New York Times and the Washington Post and the Chicago Tribune and these newspapers, because he had contacts there and he writes frequently. And so I did that, and he helped me make it short and sweet and basically capture the basic flaws in the policy development and the design of this war and where those flaws emanated from, which was, you know, ideology and the willingness to lie and these kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
And he then proceeded to go through his contacts to get that published in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Chicago Tribune, and a couple other papers. And every one of them rejected it. Every one of them refused to publish it. This is in the summer of 2003, so I'm certainly not the first person complaining, right? I'm
right.
Not the first person saying this. This is not a total bombshell in any way. And plus, it was written in a very conservative critique, really, of what was going on. Rejected by the major papers, and it was then published by the Knight Ridder newspaper organization, which is, I believe, relatively independent. They centered out of Philadelphia, I believe. Owned several major papers in this country, city papers like the Philadelphia Inquirer and a paper in Miami. They have a paper in Houston, I believe, a series of that. So it's not super big, but it has reach. And they had been this paper, Knight Ridder. There's a couple of folks that you probably know from Knight Ridder who have been very good about doing their research and very good about telling the truth. As far as American media goes, I would. And it's not just because they agreed to publish my stuff. I think that because it was only that one thing that I ever wrote for them. But they have been very good. They've just
closest
been,
thing we've got to a press.
It really is the closest thing we've got to an independent press. They will challenge the Washington story. They will challenge the White House, and they have done so. And I'm sure at great cost to themselves. In any case, it was this paper that published the op-ed. And of course, once it was out, it became. Amongst people that were interested in American critique of our policy, it became, you know, pretty well read. And I also later wrote a longer series for the American Conservative magazine, which is all available online in December and January of 2003, early 2004. And then I wrote another piece related to that, very similar, a little bit shorter, for Salon.com.
Yeah.
And so the word is out on at least what I saw, and basically all I've written beyond my commentary. I mean, everyone has opinions, but those particular things, the op-ed in the summer, the American Conservative more detailed piece, and the piece for Salon, basically do nothing more than share for everyone who wasn't in the Pentagon exactly what I saw when I was there. And so you can draw your own conclusions.
Well,
it's something that is not certainly not classified, but it's just kind of an eyewitness reporting, which we need more of.
Well, I'm going to make a leap here, and you know, this is a hard one for me because I want to qualify this first that I have many loving and caring Jewish friends, but most of our media outlets are controlled by a cabal of Jewish media moguls, as well as the cabal that's controlling most of the Pentagon information that was going up to these neocons, and they're actually in the same Zionist movement. And this is a difficult thing to tell everybody, but the fact of the matter is this seems to be building up in my view as a conspiracy that has Zionists all over it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's terrible in the fact that there are many wonderful Jewish people who are going to get swept up in this in being blamed for this. But the truth is it is pretty clearly what I see is a conspiracy at the very highest levels of our government. Mm-hmm. To work closely with the Jewish state to affect their policies almost exclusively, and our press is hiding that fact from the public.
Mm-hmm. Well, here's my take on it, and I've thought a great deal about this. The Jewish folk who are part of the neoconservative movement and who are behind this particular invasion of Iraq, you know, the promulgating of lies and the what we've done to Iraq, which has all been done on purpose. You know, it's not Iraq is not a free and independent state with free democracy and running water because we wanted it to be and couldn't do it. We absolutely intend, American policy intends for Iraq to be a broken place, and it's broken now. We have military bases there, and it's all good as far as the American policymakers are concerned. But I will say this. The Jewish folk in the Pentagon particularly, I don't know anything about the ones in the media, but the Jewish folk in the Pentagon who had pursued this are not good Jews, quite frankly. They're not religious Jews in that sense. These are people that will break the Ten Commandments. And as far as I know, the Ten Commandments apply very much, are part of the Talmud, and that is definitely part of the teaching. So these folks are not representative of the Jewish people in my book at all. Mm-hmm. And second off, if you look at American Jews, and I don't know anything about international opinion, but if you look at American Jews, as far as you can categorize them as a voting bloc, which you really can't, but of course every ethnic group is, you know, is and religious groups are categorized that way. If you look at American Jews, they're largely Democrat, 80%. They are split. In fact, the majority of them don't support what's going on in Iraq. They see very correctly that the American actions in Iraq have hurt Israel. They haven't made Israel safer. They haven't made Israel better. They've made Israel, in many ways, in fact, people who are inclined not to favor Israel are now more inclined not to favor Israel.
Yeah.
So nothing that has been done by the neoconservatives has helped either Judaism in general. It has not helped Israel. Now, that said, do they believe that they, in following the Likud line, in following maybe a more pro-Zionist line, do they believe they're helping Israel? It may be that some of them do think that. Mm-hmm. The facts bear out that they're not helping Israel. Israel is far more in far more danger today than she has been in any time previously. In fact, the economy, Israel's economy, is totally dependent on either military sales, with a lot of the stuff that they've gotten from America that they're reselling to people we don't want them to sell to. That's one way to make money. And another way is of course, tourism, which has been totally stymied by events both before and after 9/11. And certainly the Iraq War has hurt their economy. Their ability to make a living in Israel has been harmed by the American actions. And so if they think they're helping Israel, then that's just one more example of how the neoconservatives delude themselves in what
it is.
Well,
one of the things I want to start doing for the people who listen, you know, when you say neoconservative, then you add conservative to it. These people are, as you know, and the listeners know, are anything but conservative.
Absolutely, they're radical revolutionaries, and most of the philosophy stems from Trotskyism, and they look at international revolution. They are not conservatives. Conservatives, Edmund Burke conservatives, the kind of conservatives that Americans like to think that they are all about building on the past, gradually changing it, shaping it, and improving it, and handing off something that includes a heritage, that includes a history, to the next generation. That's an Edmund Burke conservative, and that's how they view the way change, including government change, should happen. These neoconservatives, which own the Republican Party, they aren't the majority of the Republican Party, but they set the policies for the Republican Party. They set the policies for George W. Bush. The neoconservatives are very much about destroying. They are very much in the another French guy, Rousseau. They're very much in the line of Rousseau. Let's make a clean slate. Let's clean everything off. Let's tear away the chains that of culture and history and religion and all these things that hold us back. And let's be free. This is an idea from Jean-Jacques Rousseau, and they embrace that, which is not part of the American tradition at all. They are neoconservatives, and neo is what's important. They're very new. They're very different. They're not conservative at all. They're very radical.
Right. Well, I like to call them something different than conservative, because mm-hmm. it gives people who are truly conservative
sure.
a bad rap afterwards.
Yes, sure.
One of the things I want to do is I want to maybe make a link here to your relationship with some other military people. There are clearly a lot of people in the Pentagon and around the country in our military who are aware of the DU problems and the fact that we're poisoning the nation and we're there under false pretenses, and that we've destroyed our soft power around the world, mm-hmm. and I mean on and on and on, and they must be up in arms, many people. And what can you give me some insights and the listeners some insights into what kind of state our military higher echelon of the military is in right now relating to these policies?
Well, I don't have a real good sense of it when it comes to the flag officers, the general level, the executive level of the military. I really don't know. The ones who speak out most consistently about what we're doing, not just to the world and to our nation, but to our military itself, are folks like General Zinni, who's retired, and guys like Brent Scowcroft, who's part of the Father Bush administration.
Yeah.
These guys and many other retired generals are speaking out, but the active duty generals are keeping their mouths shut. There was a guy, in fact, that an Air Force JAG officer was just recently, he was a three-star general. He had challenged repeatedly Rumsfeld's ability to torture in Guantanamo. He kept pointing up the fact.
I wonder why.
I don't know. You know, perhaps it was the right thing to do. I don't know.
Maybe, yeah.
Yeah. This guy got brought up on charges. In fact, the general, there was a General Cook who I used to work for on the air staff, who was the convening officer for these charges. From the charges that he was brought up on, he's a married man, and he was brought up on charges of improper relationships, but not adultery, which is unusual because adultery, of course, is very common, and it's an easy charge in the military code of conduct, and they usually throw that in there. They didn't charge him with adultery. They charged him with improper relationship, which is kind of like who knows what that is. In any case, the interesting thing was this guy was demoted completely down from three-star general to colonel. He wasn't even, you know, usually a demotion. First off, there should be a retirement for something like that at the same rank. But they devoted him down to a colonel. And I think in part that was to send a message that if you intend to speak out as a retired person, that we're going to make sure that that doesn't happen. But for the most part, they're not speaking out at the flag officer level. At the colonel and lieutenant colonel level, I'm not seeing a lot of it. But at the folks that are doing the fighting, the sergeants and the NCOs and the lower level officers, I think some of these folks are starting to we're seeing a lot of folks here in America who come back, they refuse to go back to Iraq, and they say this is not a war that America should be fighting. This is a war that is based on false pretenses, and it's not a war, it's a slaughter. For example, folks involved in some of the things they did in Fallujah do not feel that that was a war in any way just, but simply just a destruction.
A modern-day Dresden.
A modern-day Dresden, exactly. And, you know, there's huge moral consequences to that kind of thing, and we're continuing to do it. So I think there's young men and women, and I have to say young, because I think they're under 30 years old, under 35 years old, who are speaking out. And the other group that I hear from, of course, is, again, retired guys. I hear from all kinds of folks that are veterans, World War II veterans, Vietnam veterans, Korean veterans, veterans of Somalia, veterans of the first Gulf War. These are the folks that write me, but they're not in the military now, and they're very upset by what they're seeing. You know, and again, the families is the other aspect. There are some families that are speaking out about what's been done with their children and their spouses opposing the war. But it's very alarming to me. It's concerning to me that we're not seeing generals, active duty generals in the Pentagon or in parts of the military that are willing to stand up and say, we're not doing this.
You want to venture a guess as to why? It can't just be fear, because these people, I mean, so, you know.
They sold out for promotion. Yeah, I think it's not just promotion. I mean, certainly it's job security. It's the promise of future employment afterwards. I mean, we do have in this country, I think the whole world is quite aware of it, and Americans are aware of it as well. We have a military-industrial complex, and it's quite massive. If you intend to work as a military officer, and oftentimes as a retired NCO, and you want to make good money, the best money that you can make is not going back to your hometown and managing the Winn-Dixie. Okay? That's not where you're going to make the money. The money's going to be made by working for the Northrop Grumman's and working for the Raytheon and working for the Halliburton.
That's presuming that we have anything to come back to, Karen. You know, you and I both know, being involved in this truth thing, we've both taken that red pill, proverbial red pill. The truth is now that we've taken this, we know where we're heading, and these people have children and grandchildren, as you and I both do, and we know the kind of mess we're leaving to our future generations, and I cannot understand the cowardice involved in a line officer going along with this kind of horrific policy.
There is no excuse for it whatsoever. It's cowardice, but you've got to realize in the past 20 or 30 years since Vietnam, we have created and promoted senior officers that more likely than not embrace cowardice, and they don't call it cowardice, they call it loyalty. We have created a military that is not as likely to stand up and challenge civilian authority, and not even to challenge civilian lies. It's just an amazing situation that we're in. And quite frankly, that's one of the things that the active duty people of my age, early 40s, people who are in the senior officer corps, do complain about. They complain about the piss poor leadership, excuse my language, of the the military leadership. In fact, you can read the stuff about Iraq, and they'll complain about the leadership. They feel that there's not good leadership, military leadership, for the troops, and that again is reflective of this larger problem that we have.
Well, we don't have leadership in any area of our nation today. And the truth is, we don't have any leadership in our religious institutions. We don't have any leadership in our states. The fact is that we are in terrible, serious trouble in the country. And everyone that's listening to this broadcast right now across the world are very well aware of it. My next question is, and because you have some insights that are pretty powerful, what do you where do we go from here, Karen? I mean, how can we get our country back in your view? Just give me some insights, your own opinion. This is not necessarily factual.
Sure. Well, one of the things I was saying about that you were talking about the country going, our America in big trouble. We're in bigger trouble than we think. And some of the signs are already in the news today as far as, you know, we live on our debt. We sell our treasury bonds. You know, we sell this stuff, sell our debt so we can spend more money. South Korea and Russia have both decided to change their portfolios to stop this purchase, to stop this funding of American deficit and debt spending. As that continues to happen, the country's economy is going to collapse. And we're going to be in for a hard time. So what people can do?
I agree. We got to hold on. We've got one more break here, and then we're going to close out the show. Hold on with me, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be right back. Ladies and gentlemen, we're back. You know, Karen, you are a courageous lady. I got to tell you, I'm very proud of you, very much so. And I got to tell you, I told you earlier on a phone call, you know, I've never failed at anything that I set my mind to, never once in my life. And I am committed to changing what's happening in our country. And we have a chance today, people listening and you, we could make history. And I don't see our situation as hopeless, although we are definitely, our back is against the wall and we need to move quickly. I have to tell you, these people are pure evil. And I think the evil that they are is coming to light. And I do have a sense that the American people are strong enough to stand up to these folks. It's just going to take some more information, and information like yours, Karen. So why don't you have a statement? Maybe you can give everybody an idea of what you'd like to see them do, maybe for the next years to come here.
Well, in the years to come, I think what's going to happen, what needs to happen, is American people, all of us from all different walks of life, need to start behaving more like our founding fathers, more like our forefathers. We need to start questioning what we're told. We need to start, when we're told to get in line, we need to say, I don't think so. We need to challenge authority. This country was built on people that were very comfortable in challenging authority, and we're going to have to return to that if we want to keep our country going. And we have to take a personal responsibility for the future of America. It's not just something that happens in Washington. Washington has got us to where we are in this situation, people that are not accountable, government leaders who are not accountable to the people. And so they won't volunteer to be accountable to the people. They will only respond when the people insist that they are accountable. And so in any way that can be done, I mean, through educating people, through media, through people who simply, in their own way, in their own lives, can be an example of standing up against things that are wrong, things that are false. This is very basic, but that's what we're going to have to do. And we may be helped by our foreign allies and foreign adversaries when they stop funding America's debt and deficit spending. Because when they stop paying for it, our policymakers will have to come back to America, the own people, and they'll say, hey, pay for this. And at that point, we need to say, no, we're not going to pay for this. We're not going to put up for this, and we're going to change it. So we have many things that point in a positive direction, not necessarily pleasant. It may be very painful for America, the nation. But the direction is, I think the tide is turning. It's not just the rest of the world that's not going to tolerate American imperialism. It's Americans themselves. They're not going to pay for it anymore. So I think we have some chances, but people have to take that individual personal responsibility to behave very much like this icon of what an American frontiersman is. We need to go back and kind of embrace our the strength that we can find in our own history and behave in that way, and I think that will get us through this.
Well, I think a bit, the biggest suggestion I could make to the public is there is the most important thing in your house is the off button on your television. And they're more important than anything in the whole building that you live in is the off button on your TV.
Absolutely.
Shut the TV off. Stop getting blasted by lies.
That's right.
And pick up a book. Get involved in your community. Start screaming from the rooftops. And pick up an RBN live sticker to put on the bumper of your car so that everybody in this country can hear this broadcast and wonderful people like you, Karen. You're truly one of my heroes. And I got to tell you, I'm so proud that you came on my show, and you know, you're going to hear a lot from me. We're gonna become friends, whether you like it or not.
No, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. Well, thank you very much.
It's been a great time, and ladies and gentlemen, I want you to listen for next week. We got great stuff lined up for you. I'll see you guys next week.